The Secrets of Stargate is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to The Secrets of Stargate, episode 151.
General West, Jackson has identified the seventh symbol.
All right, here we go. We are about to try to make a connection.
All we gotta do is bust out of here, commandeer the ship, and fly on home.
Indeed. You say that a lot.
I know that this could be dangerous. But this is our job, right? It's what we signed on to do.
It was never about going home. It's about getting us to where we're going.
Hi, I'm Jack Berezini, and you're listening to The Secret to Stargate, where we talk about the hidden meanings and deeper layers found in the Stargate movies, TV series, and more. And joining me today are Father Corey Stika. Hi, Father.
Howdy, Jack.
And Lisa Jones. Hi, Lisa.
Hey, Jack.
And Victor Lambs. Hey, Victor.
I am Jinto. Hi, Jack. Fan favorite nice. Jinto there.
Yes.
Yes. I was going to say, he gave me Boxy from the original Battlestar Galactica vibes. Mm-hmm. So.
Very much so.
Well, that means we're jumping into Stargate Atlantis. I've been looking forward to this. So we'll be talking about the season, the series premiere, also the season premiere, I guess, of Stargate Atlantis Rising, or depending on where you watch it, Rising Parts 1 and 2. The Atlantis expedition, led by Dr. Elizabeth Weir, arrives in the Pegasus Galaxy after discovering the lost city of Atlantis. Left behind by the ancients millions of years ago, John Shepard, initially just General O'Neill's helicopter pilot and escort, joins the expedition after he discovers that his high percentage of ancient DNA allows him to interface with their technology. Colonel Sumner, the expedition's military leader, is not happy about this due to Shepard's tarnished record in Afghanistan. They find the city submerged and the power levels dropping, which will result in the force field protecting the city from being flooded failing. We're introduced to Major John Shepard, who goes with a team to a planet where he meet the Athosians, a human race who are considered food stock for the beings they call the Wraith. The Wraith attack and capture several members of the away team, as well as Tayla, the Athosian leader. Shepard returns to Atlantis and leads a rescue mission to save the prisoners from the Wraith. Their Wraith keeper, who looks like an extra from a Marilyn Manson music video, takes Sumner and begins torturing him for information while draining his life force. Though he is forced to mercy kill Sumner, Shepard is able to rescue the prisoners and, in classic Stargate fashion, blow things up with C4. They all return to Atlantis as the city's power fails. Fortunately, the city rises to the top of the ocean and everybody is saved. The end. For now.
The end, or is it the beginning?
Exactly. What are your thoughts on this episode, Father?
Well, this is, you know, for an opening episode, for an episode that its whole purpose is exposition. Mm-hmm. We need to be introduced to a new galaxy, a new Stargate command, for lack of better words, a new, you know, sender hub, a new set of teams, a new leader, new everything. It does a great job. And of course, new bad guy, you know, new bad guys. We got to find out who the new villains are going to be. And it does all that. And it does it in a way that's pretty entertaining. I mean, it's a good story. It's an interesting story. It is definitely no Farpoint Station, if you know, from TNG. It is definitely nothing like that. It is a very good opening story. And of course, one we all four of us have been looking forward to, because we finally get into Atlantis.
Yes, definitely. What about you, Lisa?
I'm with Father Corey. I love that they very quickly move from, hey, we're at Antarctica, and then all of a sudden we're climbing through the gate and let the action begin. And they just give you a little taste of the different characters, the bad guys. I think the city of Atlantis itself becomes its own character. Mm-hmm. So it's exciting. This is not, I mean, SG-1 I've watched a million times, and I've not watched Atlantis very many times. So, I'm not new to it. It's exciting to watch again. And I'd forgotten how much I liked Shepard how subdued Rodney was, which is it like messes with your head, because the last time we saw him in SG-1, he was horrible. So overall, good start to the show.
And the dynamics between Rodney and Shepard are, you get just a little taste of it in this.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. I'm glad to see Rodney back and to see the, I guess he's the semi-rehabilitated Rodney. He's not super obnoxious, but he does mention his limit allergy at the end there. So
yeah, we still get that. Yep.
What about you, Victor?
Yeah, I like this a lot. I got chills several times watching it just because of, you know, getting to spend time with these characters again. Even the, you know, characters in the background, you're like, oh, there's Grodin, there's Bates. And then you think about the stories that they'll have coming up. And yeah, just even the scene in Antarctica when Dr. Beckett is there and Rodney's there, you're like, oh, these guys, I've been waiting this so long to see these guys again, yes, because I haven't been watching Atlantis because we've been watching Stargate. And then, you know, when the city rises up, you know, they're doomed, the shield's failing. And then all of a sudden the failsafe kicks in and the city, you know, this huge epic, you know, effect shot of the city and the water being displaced. And then the wave, you know, emanating off of it as it sits there in the sun. It's a beautiful shot. It's just, you know, so full of memories and good feelings for me. So really excited to be talking about Atlantis again.
Yeah, definitely. I really enjoyed it. It still definitely feels like Stargate, but it has its own distinct flavor, which I really like. Mm-hmm. And I like just the idea of setting it on a city that is also kind of a space station and also kind of a spaceship, but it's its own thing. Like that's definitely a unique idea, because putting something on a ship or on a station, like that's all been done before. And I'm excited to see where they go with that, because with something the size of a city, that gives you a lot of different things you can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if the set itself looks familiar, it's also the set of Blade Trinity again. So, which first we saw as Thor's ship. Yeah. They purchased it from the people who made Blade.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And because they needed a big, huge set. So I think it was originally like a Skyrise or something. Set. And so that's why we get so many different layers and balconies and, you know, gate rooms and labs and conference rooms and, you know, hangars and stuff, is because they bought a big, huge set that they could, you know, redress and use. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. It's the SGC always felt a little, it was very cramped because it's an underground space.
Well, it's a missile silo. I mean, true. It's a redressed missile silo is what it is. So makes sense.
Yeah.
They even gave it like craftsman style stained glass, and
yeah,
I mean, they prettied it up really nicely.
So it's cool to see the design. Yeah, it's nice that we also got kind of your crossover with Daniel and Jack there at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And it's funny to see, like, because the show is from the perspective of the Atlantis team, you're almost getting Jack as like the outside character who might throw a wrench in the works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's not Jack. He's Brigadier General O'Neill.
Yeah.
You know,
much more serious.
Yeah. And that's where, you know, of course, his humor's still there, you know, and things like that. But yeah, he very much isn't the leader of the team. Instead, he's the boss.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which makes it all that much more funny when Dr. Beckett almost shoots him down with a drone.
Yeah,
you know, shoots down his helicopter. And there was some pretty exciting, you know, they were talking about it on the commentary, you know, about how, you know, the helicopter pilots, they had like, you know, four helicopters flying at the same time, some of the stunt flying, you know, that they had to do. But still, that's a really good scene, you know, when they're trying to evade the drone. They finally do a little crash landing, and then the drone skids across the ice and lands right at Jack's feet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which it wasn't supposed to. They just got a lucky throw. They had, you know, their prop person throwing the little jellyfish at Richard Dean Anderson. It was supposed to, you know, land of like 20 feet away or something, but it just one throw just skidded right up to his feet and stayed there. And so they're like, that's going in the show.
That's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like that they used they actually got a helicopter and filmed with it and filmed their own scenes, and then just used some either stock footage or CGI. So that was exciting.
Although if you know aircraft registration, you'll immediately recognize that, yes, this was filmed in Canada, because it's a C-whatever registration on the helicopter. You know, in United States, it's N whatever. In Canada, it's C whatever.
Well, they have expedition members from like, what, 26 countries or something. Yeah. I forget what it is exactly. Yeah. So they might have snuck a Canadian helicopter in there.
The U.S. Air Force borrowed one.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, for their U.S. Air Force pilot.
Yeah. I also saw that the actor who plays John Shepard, he apparently can actually fly a helicopter, but they would not let him fly while filming the show. Because it was too much of like a liability with the insurance and just the safety. But apparently he wanted to fly it and they would not let him.
That's funny.
He at least got to do the cutoff lever for the engine. So,
yeah. Okay. I didn't know he was actually a pilot, but that makes sense because they were saying on the commentary later on, he gets to fly another ship, which we'll get to. And he was playing that very serious, like an actual pilot would. You know, not registering any information. Just if you're a pilot in your ship, it's just all, you know, professional. And they actually had to reshoot the scenes to, you know, make it a little bit more animated and excited and less realistic, but more dramatic.
Exactly. Interesting. Yeah. I also was wondering, he's in the military. His hair does not look very regulation. And
a little bit longer, but
yeah,
not that much. Then again, you know, he's a pilot, so he can get away with it.
True. He can wear his helmet. So, and with his character, he's got something that happened to him that involved a team member dying and him, or a team. He saved his team by disobeying an order, and this has put a black mark on his record, which Dr. Weir tries to use as a reason to not take him on the expedition. Or Jack tries to use his reason not to let Elizabeth Weir take him on the expedition. And of course, she's able to throw that one back in his face pretty easily.
Yeah, I've read your record too.
Yeah, and creates tension with Sumner, who's like a by the book Marine colonel.
Yeah.
He's also a Terminator. So
yeah.
Yeah. Played by the great Robert Patrick.
Yes. Yeah. And I liked that with between Shepard and Sumner that they didn't overplay the drama with that. Like I was worried that that's going to be like, oh, there's going to be some like big blow up over this, but there really wasn't. And you end up feeling pretty bad for Sumner by the end of it.
Yeah.
Well, you can see there's a little bit, he kind of starts to develop a little bit more appreciation for Shepard as it goes on, you know, where he's not really an equal, of course, you know, a colonel and a major aren't equals in the military ranks, but at least, you know, someone he could take advice from.
Yeah, there's a wonderful scene where, you know, they're having dinner with the Ethosians for the first time, and Shepard is breaking the ice by asking all sorts of, you know, questions that no alien would get or understand.
Yeah.
And you know, Bates is trying to call him out on it, but you can see Sumner like smiling and saying, okay, let's see where he's going with this type thing. And it turns out to, you know, it does build trust with the Ethosians, which is crucial in this episode and becomes crucial, you know, in future episodes too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Taylor says, well, we don't trade with friend or with strangers. He goes, well, I guess we'll have to become friends. And he starts talking about being, you know, like Ferris wheels. I love Lieutenant Ford. They're not going to understand any of that, sir.
Yeah.
I love it. Cause it just gives you a little taste of his personality, you know, how it's going to go moving forward.
I also like that he's not like he's definitely got a lot of bravado, but he's not like super sarcastic like Jack is. So I'm glad they're not trying to redo that same character over again.
Yeah.
He fills the same role, but he's not the same character.
And then as you see a little bit later with the numbers where Rodney's trying to add up things or talk about how many
permutations,
right, and he's, you know, he's doing that math really quickly in his head, and everyone's like, "What? Wait, what?"
Yeah,
so I like that they again use that as a differentiation from O'Neill, that he's not going to just play stupid all the time.
And actually, that becomes part of the fun of the Rodney and Shepard relationship is because Shepard is actually as smart, if not smarter, than Rodney, but he just doesn't do it. Like I think I'm right. Shepard's was offered to join Mensa and he refused.
Yes.
Yeah, that does come up later. Yeah.
You know, things like that. And that's part of what just drives Rodney nuts. It's like, this dude's smart enough to be in Mensa and he's like, nah.
Yeah.
And he only does it to get under Rodney's skin. Yep. But that was another point of contention, was I think they wanted Shepard originally to play things, you know, a bit more animated. Like when he finds out about the Stargate and the alien, the ancient base, just like, what's going on, you know, type thing. But, you know, Joe Flanagan wouldn't play it that way. He just said, no, this guy's he's thinking, he's more subdued. He's analyzing things. He's not another Jack O'Neill. And yep. I think the show and his character certainly are better for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Do they ever tie, well, I guess this would be spoilers, but I'm wondering if they would tie his intelligence to the fact that he has a high percentage of ancient DNA because he's able to telepathically interface with all their technology, which is why he gets on the team.
Nope.
Yeah. But that would have been good.
He's just smart.
That would have been good. Yeah. He's just smart. Yeah.
Spoilers. Eventually they do kind of take that whole thing out of the picture anyways, eventually.
Yeah.
So.
No superpowers.
Yeah.
Nope.
Mm-mm. No,
but he happens to be really, really smart. And well, of course he was Air Force and became a pilot. So I guess that would show it. No.
Nice.
But we get to see Daniel Jackson being all Daniel Jackson-y and stammering and explaining things. And it's kind of cool to see like old school, Daniel Jackson. Yeah. And
That's a great scene where, was it Weir and O'Neill are standing there talking and, oh, there you are. I've been looking for you. Starts to walk off, turns around, follow me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very Daniel Jackson.
Yeah.
Yes.
He really wants to go on the expedition, but Jack's got to shoot him down. I like when they're all going through the gate to Atlantis and he's like, well, I can just go grab my things real quick. And he's like, nope.
That's one of those where it's like, but I could, nope, but nope.
Yeah. And there are so many big, huge things like revelations about like the Stargate and the whole world of Stargate that they just have to throw in as one line. Like Daniel Jackson on the whiteboard just says, oh yeah, this is an 8-symbol address, right? You know, the 7th symbol is not the point of origin. It shows that you have to go to another galaxy and then that becomes like huge, right? 8 gate address, chevron addresses go to another galaxy and you're like, okay, that totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like calling long distance.
When I first saw it, I don't think it really, I don't think it really registered. It didn't like, oh, okay. But now watching it again, you're like, wait, they just hand waved that. They just figured it out in like 5 minutes and then like, okay, let's go. And it's like, okay.
Well, and they don't even say where he got the 7th address. Cause of course 8th was the Earth address, the origin address, but they don't ever say, well, where did he get this other address he just writes up there? It's just like, yeah, we need this address too.
Yeah. But it worked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that they don't spend too much time on that because that's one of those things where to tie all the pieces together, it could end up becoming very just bogged down with exposition. Mm-hmm. And I like that they're just like, yeah, that's something that Daniel would probably figure out at some point. And you can just go with it.
Yeah. Because think about it. They could have done the whole first episode or, one-parter, just them trying to get to Atlantis.
Right.
But instead, I didn't look at the time. We're there really quickly.
It's not even halfway through the episode. Yeah. And they're at Atlantis.
Yeah.
And that's like even that. With a secret scene that they throw in that isn't on. If you're watching this on streaming, you might not see it.
Yeah,
might not. I didn't.
I didn't either.
Yeah. So there's a scene where Jack's trying to talk Shepard into joining the expedition. Shepard's originally just kind of lukewarm on the idea, but then he strides into the gate room. We see him stride into the gate room, so we know that he's made his decision. There was another scene that the director, Martin Wood, and a bunch, I think maybe even some of the writers didn't want to include, but either the producers or the network made him include. And it's the one where we see the loved ones saying goodbye. We see Weir's fiance or boyfriend watching her goodbye video. And he's played by, of course, Nareem. So we get to see where like,
Garwin Sanford.
Yeah, you're like, okay,
whenever
I guess. Nareem's in this. And then we get to see, Dr. Beckett's mom, which becomes a running, thing that he refers to. And then Rodney handing his cat off to a neighbor. But they didn't want that put in there because it gives too much away about who the major characters of the show is going to be, that Beckett's going to be a major character, that McKay is going to be a major character. But as you mentioned, Jack, when we were talking, it was kind of a good misdirection to have, you know, to cast, Robert Patrick as one of the characters. And you're like, oh, cool. He's going to be like the main action star of the show going forward.
Nope. Yeah, and for those who haven't seen it because they're watching the streaming version, the scene where Shepard is convinced to go is they're sitting in the helicopter, you know, getting ready to fly back to civilization, basically back to McMurdo, and Shepard's just like, "Nah, I'm not interested. You know, I'm happy where I'm at and everything like that." And Jack just basically says, "So why did you become a pilot?" And Shepard giving an answer you'd never expect, because he said people who don't want to, I think, are crazy. And O'Neill says, "Well, I think people who don't want to go through the Stargate are equally as whack. If you can't give me an answer by the time we get back, McMurdo, I don't want you anyways."
Yeah, so.
It's funny when I was rewatching it.
And then the next scene, is him walking through SGC.
When I was rewatching it this week, it was funny because we went the streaming. I saw it on Amazon and on Hulu. I watched it both to see if it was there, because the first time I'm watching it, we went straight from Weir saying she wants him, and you know, Jack saying, "Well, did you ask him?" And she says yes, and then it cuts straight from that to them at the SGC, like getting ready to dial up the gate, and you're like, I remember thinking we skipped something. Like, I know there was something else here.
Yeah, you missed the whole him saying no.
Yeah. And Jack having to talk him into it and everybody saying goodbye.
Yeah. And it wasn't until I was reading through the credits and I saw Nareem in the credits and I went, "Now I know I didn't see, like, I know I didn't fall asleep." Yeah.
Simon was there. Release the Simon cut.
Nice. I also noticed if you watch it on Amazon Prime or wherever it's split up into two, it has these really annoying like title card, like it's like the credit break, I guess, that pops up at various times throughout the episode where it just says Stargate Atlantis on the screen and then it fades to black. Like they didn't put a lot of trouble into cleaning up those broadcast versions for the platforms.
No.
Yeah.
And the DVD, both the DVD and Blu-ray do the all one movie format. Mm-hmm. So it's an hour and a half long movie, basically.
And I think that's how it premiered, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. They probably broke it up for syndication, trimmed it up.
Well, it's the same, Children of the Gods, SG-1's premiere. That was the same thing. It premiered as the movie format and then broke it up for syndication and cut out a couple of scenes that needed to be cut out. Maybe that's why they did it. You know, they figured, hey, if SG-1's premiere needed to be edited, this needs to be edited.
We'll cut out Dr. Beckett's mom. Also what I like about this, and this is also kind of just tossed in and you blink and you'll miss it, or, you know, if you're not paying attention, the whole chronology of the ancients too, that they evolved, you know, they evolved on Earth, seeded the Milky Way galaxy. There was a plague. They had to pack up real quick and leave the Milky Way galaxy. And that's the prologue. We get to see Aliana. Yep. Who is we found in the Frozen episode, who they thawed out. She was the one left behind. The actress's real life husband was playing her husband in scene too. He gets on a ship and vamooses it to the Pegasus galaxy. And then, and so humans and everybody else in the galaxy is actually the second evolution of the human
form. The ship
form.
We see going to the Pegasus galaxy was Atlantis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it goes to the Pegasus galaxy, like ancients and humanity die out in the Milky Way galaxy. They re-evolve again somehow. Meanwhile, in the Pegasus galaxy, the ancients make a mess of things there and have to leave through the gate back to the Milky Way galaxy again 10,000 years ago. So it's really cool that they finally give like the chronology of the ancients in this episode. But again, it's so fast and so subtle.
And this is one of these great where they did an exposition dump, but they did it in a good way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where they showed, you know, this hologram of the ancient and explaining everything. And of course it was like, oh, this is so great. You know, we don't know, the viewers don't know it, but neither do the crew, neither do the crew of Atlantis. They don't know it either. Mm-hmm. So
right. Yeah, it is. It's like the ancients are just couch surfing the galaxies and messing everything up.
Yeah, they basically populated the Pegasus galaxy and then like left all of their descendants essentially to be food for the raid.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Wow. Yeah. Kind of deadbeat.
Yeah, but they not before they try to come up with some ways to combat the Wraith that also go horribly wrong, and we'll see those in the next few seasons.
Yep, exactly.
I've heard a lot about. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah.
I was like, we have another arrogant, super advanced race that's can't get out of its own way.
They are. I like the aesthetic, but it's also very weird. It's like death metal, like raver goth aliens. Oh, the first thing they see.
They're simultaneously terrifying and even campier than the Gould somehow. And I don't know how that should work, right? They have like the leather duster jackets. and like the Wraith Keeper Queen, she'll later become the Queen, is dialed up to 11. But at the same time, they're way more terrifying than the Gould ever were.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've forgotten how gross the teeth were.
Yeah. And the fact that they could just heal themselves, you know, I think that's the one time we actually see them do the transition between the bullet holes and healed. Mm-hmm. But
yeah. And we get that goopy little hand that's walking along the ground.
Yeah.
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 And you think of Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Let's put it in the drawer.
Way to go, Thing. You're really on the ball.
Yeah. But there's the scene where after they've brought the first Athosian guy in, and Sumner comes in and sees him at the table, and he's been totally turned 9,000 years old, a la Indiana Jones. He's like standing there, and then the Wraith Keeper like pops up behind him, but in like this really weird, like it's almost like a like dance thing.
Well, kind of drops behind him, or you know,
pops up and drops down. Yeah,
it's just weird. It's like what is going on? But I like that they're not just doing the Gould again or something much more normal. Like they're going with something that is weird and kind of unsettling, and I like it.
Well, I'm sure you appreciated their one talent though, Jack. Having as a fan of Dune, the Wraith used the voice.
Oh yeah, that's true. They do.
Oh, too. Is that the subconscious thing that they do?
They speak, you will kneel, and he kneels.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought of that scene when that happened.
Yeah. Yeah. And they mentioned on the commentary that Andy Frizzell, who plays the Wraith Keeper, and later we'll see her as the Wraith Queen, is apparently 6'1", I think.
Mm-hmm. Six foot. 6 foot's what the
6 foot. Okay.
Wiki says, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a yoga instructor. And so that's how she was able to, you know, contort and move. And move around in a Wraith-like fashion. But it was just even cool seeing the inside of the Wraith ship, because we see a lot of insides of Wraith ships over the course of the series and stuff.
And the darts, the Wraith darts, you see a lot of those.
And which the darts I love. With the masks.
One thing I forgot, they sound like mosquitoes.
Yeah.
They just got that high-pitched whine of mosquitoes, and it's like, that's so appropriate. Yeah. And I completely forgot about it.
Or like electric guitar feedback.
Yeah. That's probably what they did, but
yeah.
So I have another question about a scene that I wonder if got cut, because I know that Taylor explained that they can get inside your head, make you see things.
Oh yeah.
Right? Jack, did you see her say that? Because I don't remember her saying that on the, it's like the new episode started and it's like there was a jump.
Yeah, and she comes up to Sumner and says that they're not there. You know, the Wraith can make you see things, and then does it again with Lieutenant Ford towards the end.
I saw the Lieutenant Ford one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I didn't see the Sumner one.
Did they have the scene where she finds Shepard finds her necklace on the ground and said, okay, so at least they did that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because that's important.
It's interesting they would have cut that too, because that's kind of an important plot point.
I don't think that was in the version that I watched, but I just kind of went with it. I was like, they can manipulate people, obviously. So
yeah, because you get like these spectral ghost look, you know, fog kind of things, and they start shooting at them. You know, Sumner starts shooting at them.
Yeah,
you know? Of course, there's nothing behind it, but And Taylor comes up, you know, stop, this isn't real. They can trick your mind. They can make you see things that aren't really there. And then says, like, shoot at that, and points at the dart.
That's know. Where we came in, was that she came up to them and said, stop shooting here, shoot at the right. plane, at the darts. But she never, at least in that part, before Sumner was taken, she never told them that they weren't there.
Yeah, so they like cut it there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's so too bad. I just thought of that. That was, because at the time I'm like, wait a minute. I know that she said that to them.
Hmm. Yeah. So
yeah, I figured they were trying to make it fit for time for two episodes.
Oh, I guess. Yeah, that's probably the issue of syndication is probably, I never even thought of that. They had to cut it down a little bit for syndication to fit with commercial breaks and everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so in addition to shooting in HD now for the first time for the show, we also get our first like CG Stargate on a planet. They don't actually use the Stargate prop when they're on the planets anymore. That the Stargate is now CG.
Hmm.
And that, you know, of course, we're now seeing, I think we had one Death Glider go through a gate at some point in the UAVs, certainly. But now we see, you know, travel through the gate by ships, which is another.
The puddle jumpers.
The puddle jumpers, the Wraith darts.
That's such a great conversation.
Yes.
It's a ship that goes through the gate. It's a gate ship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he doesn't let Ford name anything anymore.
No. Nice. And then Rodney starts to argue. I thought we were calling it gate ship.
Yeah.
Life sign detector.
Well, of course, puddle jumpers are like an actual airplane name. It's for the little, like, you know, single prop or dual prop passenger planes that fly, you know, short distances.
Yeah.
You know, so that makes sense. I get a kick out of the life signs detector. It's literally, if you remember the old HP IPAC.
Yeah, it's PDAs. The PDA,
That's all it is in a case.
Yeah.
Yep.
I noticed that as soon as he pulled it out.
So. They acknowledged that on the commentary. And anytime you see Shepard holding it and pointing at it and stuff, that's Martin Wood's hands, you know, rather than bring Joe Flanagan in for like a day just to shoot him holding stuff. So when he's like pointing at it with like the P90 and stuff, that's all Martin Wood's own hands.
So Martin Wood is a hand model?
Yeah. And
George Constanza must have taught him.
From what I've like heard about other movies, even things like, you know, the Star Wars prequels, if you see something that just has somebody's hand in it, it's probably not the actor's hands. It's probably a stand-in or the director
or
the visual effects department saying, oh, I need a hand for this lightsaber shot. I'll just use my own, you know, type thing. So
that
makes sense.
Yeah.
I think the most egregious example of an actor's hands not being his hands is in the Inner Light episode of, I think it's the Inner Light episode of Next Generation, where Picard is playing the flute and it's very clearly some guy crouched in front of him holding the flute.
Oh,
and doing
that's
it for
funny. Yeah. Oh yeah.
Because the hands are at a wrong angle. And Picard's like,
it's one of those things that you don't notice until it's pointed out to you and then you can't unsee it.
Yeah.
Because Patrick Stewart's like trying to lean over the guy in front of him to like blow on it and doesn't.
That's funny.
Weird.
Yeah.
But yeah, I noticed the little detector earlier on in the episode, and it's like plugged into its dock with it, like the little keyboard in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I guess the ancients just have that. They got their little PDAs they can pop in with their little QWERTY keyboards. Yeah. Or it might have just been reusing the prop.
I do like the Pegasus Galaxy Stargates, though.
Mm-hmm.
They're cooler than the original Stargate, I gotta say.
Yeah.
My husband was, he was like, I hate that they changed it. He was like, I hate it.
It was divisive at the time, too. I mean,
they were cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was more of a digital effect than a spinning effect. Yeah. And Rodney was disappointed. He couldn't do the countdown
of
the game. So
get a move on.
Chevron 1 locked. Rodney. He just looks at her and.
Yeah, because they can dial much faster now.
Yeah, because they have actual DHDs and like everything.
Yeah. And it has to be a lot harder to memorize gauge addresses because you don't get the cool little drawings of the constellations. You actually get like the star patterns. Mm-hmm. And so as the Wraith are departing with their people in the Athosians, Shepard tells Ford to burn the gate address into his memory. And he's looking at like seven different just, you know, random constellation dots. Yeah. So kudos to him for like remembering which seven symbols he saw are six, you know.
It's so funny because nowadays you watch it and you're like, just take a picture with your phone.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Oops, we didn't have those.
Yeah.
Not quite. Yeah.
See, it's 2004.
They would pull out their little razor out. Cannon.
I had the pink one.
Nice.
Polaroid. Yeah. So, yeah, there are some pretty good firefights. The one on the planet where they're like, you know, blowing things up. That was really cool. Mm-hmm. And then they get back and Jinto's there and the city rises and,
I want to see, I assume we're going to get more exploration of the city, all the different wings that go off of it.
Oh yeah.
So I'm really looking forward to that.
Quite a bit of it. Actually, they do a really good job of showing different parts of the city and different things and finding places and having problems and, you know, all the usual.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, it takes multiple seasons to really explore the city.
Yeah.
Which is nice. Like I said, it becomes its own character in a way.
Yeah. And because it is such a large set, it makes it so easy to do bottle episodes in because there are so many different places within the city that they can shoot in.
Yeah. But we see right then, like one of my favorite sets or parts of the set, which is the balcony.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, and they did mention it was kind of weird that the first time they go on the balcony, which is one of the coolest things, it's the scene where Shepard is arguing with Weir about launching mounting a rescue mission. Mm-hmm. But that is a really good scene because, you know, in any other show or in Stargate, you know, Weir would have been right and had her way. But, you know, she has excellent points. Shepard has excellent points. And eventually they, you know, agree to do it. And I thought that was just a really effective scene where, you know, nobody's wrong. Nobody's, you know, obviously right at the beginning of the scene. You really don't know how it's going to play out.
Well, and that shows Weir's strength as a negotiator too.
Yeah.
You know, where she's willing to listen and she's saying, no, you know, now I understand where you're coming from. Now you got to understand where I'm coming from, you know, and that really shows that she was good for this position.
You have professional people acting professional in a situation that they've trained for and working on solving a problem instead of breaking down and crying.
That's all we want. Come on, writers of science fiction. Not everybody has to have anxiety and depression and crumble under pressure.
Life problem or some critical flaw or
that's true.
Or it's unrequited love or whatever.
I have anxiety and depression. I watch this to not think about it.
Exactly.
Put it on the screen.
I want to see professional, competent people doing cool things and solving problems.
Yes.
That makes me feel more professional and competent, and that's what I need.
Exactly.
I will say, I think between SG-1 and seeing her in this episode, I think they kind of, I want to say, softened her character a little bit. She was a little more a whole character, where before she was just very, you know, I don't say by the book, you know, straight, all of that. And now she, you can see that she wavers, that she's considering, that she has a sense of humor, that she, you know, they gave her a little more leeway, I guess, in how to portray the character.
Well, and realizing, of course, they're in a completely different circumstance than they were, you know, a day ago when they were back on Earth, too.
Yeah. And you see that her and Shepard, I was watching it back and I'm like, they seem awful cozy real fast. And spoiler alert, they're going to be friends. Like, I think there's no shipping. Maybe there was and I missed it. But they just become friends and it, you know, have this understanding and camaraderie and kind of rely on each other. And you saw it so fast in this episode to me.
Shepard's pretty cozy with everyone, though. It's kind of his character.
Yeah,
that's kind of why we like him so much.
I don't know if they're setting him and Taylor up, but he's putting that necklace on. He's taking an awful long time.
There was a lot of personal space there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and we get Christopher Heyerdahl, too. As Jinto's dad. He probably has a name, but I just know him as Jinto's dad. Howling. Yeah. So he's around for a few episodes. And
Nice.
Yeah.
It's always fun to see him in things because he's in so much.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. I really liked it. I went and watched several more episodes right after, which is a good sign.
Yeah, like, it is.
I wanted to keep going. So,
yeah. Oh, this series is so binge worthy. I mean, obviously SG-1 is, but Atlantis really is. I mean, you could just keep going and going.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think part of it is that they'd already kind of hit their stride with SG-1, you know, all these years of working on the show. And so they had so much of it, like the tone and, you know, kind of how they work together and do this, that it just, I don't know. I feel like Atlantis just kind of, there was no, you go back and watch Stargate season one and you're like, emancipation.
Yeah.
One false step. Days, you know, or whatever. You know, you have all those kind of episodes, and this one, you just don't have that. I feel like it just starts out on a really good note.
Yeah. They learned their lessons real quick.
Yeah. And I also like that basically they've doomed the entire galaxy in the first episode.
Yeah.
It's like the whole like Ash Williams character from Evil Dead, right? Who wants to do the right thing, but is just, you know, creates more problems than he solves. And by killing the keeper, even with her dying breath, says, ha ha, joke's on you.
Right.
And then we get that wonderful, it's like an homage almost to the second Dr. Patrick Troughton episode, Tomb of the Cybermen, when the Cybermen wake up. They're all inside their little, like, you know, plastic things, and they break out. Mm-hmm. We see all the little wraiths scurrying around in their little translucent pods. And
creepy.
Because for 10,000 years, the Wraith have been awakening like sporadically, a little bit here and there to go feed and come back in. But now the Wraith know that, you know, the Atlanteans are back, and they're all waking up all at once, which is going to have huge, big repercussions for the whole galaxy.
So they're basically goth space locusts.
Yeah.
Literally. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not going to make the humans, I mean, the Earth people, very friendly. I mean, people are going to get mad at them for what they did.
Yeah, they get mad at them for that. They get mad at them for a whole bunch of other things, too. So
yeah, that was pretty bad. I love when Taylor says, if you do not know the Wraith, go back.
Like,
what are you doing?
Yeah.
This
is
bad.
Exactly.
Go back there. Yeah. I want to go to there.
Yeah.
But
awesome. Did we have any alternate language titles for this episode?
Yeah, I mean, we got in French, we got Une Nouvelle Era, which is a new era, which is kind of nice. It's a new era for the show, a new era for the Pegasus Galaxy, certainly. And then in German, we got Aufbruch in eine neue Welt, which is departure to a new world.
Ooh.
Yeah, so.
Nice.
But I like Rising because it shows, you know, the new show is rising, the Wraith are rising, Atlantis is rising, you know, and I just love that they have this city now that they can't power, has no shields, and they're sitting ducks, and they've just woken up like the most evil force in the universe. So there are lots of places they can go from here, and they do, and I appreciate that.
Oh yeah,
nice.
It's nice.
Yeah, I'm excited, and it's gonna be, this is one thing I noticed is that because it's not just the four team members and you kind of have the background characters, I feel like that's probably going to give them less constraints on how they can write stories. Because one of the things we always touch on with SG-1 is they have a hard time balancing all four main characters well. And so having more of a larger ensemble will probably make that easier.
Yep. And we haven't even met my favorite background character yet, who is also a perfect foil for Rodney, too.
Oh, so. Yes.
Yeah, we'll see him in a couple episodes, I think. I don't know if he comes in next episode, but I don't want to spoil it.
That's what's cool. We don't even know everybody yet.
Yeah.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
So there's so much more to come.
Yep.
Awesome. Do y'all have any other thoughts on this episode?
Nothing here.
I think we talked about this either in our interview with Joe Malazzi, or I don't know which episode, one of the Rodney episodes, but originally Rodney was not supposed to be the scientist on this episode. No. And they didn't decide to use Rodney and hire David Hewlett for this until after they'd started filming. Yeah. And so knowing that and watching it, it's interesting because he's not very Rodney in some of this. And they filmed it as it was written and tried to add a little Rodney to it, but he's going to go full on Rodney soon.
He's not as obnoxious as he was with Sam, but
definitely a little more,
a
little more obnoxious.
Nice. Awesome. Before we go, we'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create the Secrets of Stargate, including Francis B., Candace G., Chris S., Sylvis Valentine, and Margot E. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue The Secret to Stargate and all the shows at StarQuest. And you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. And be sure to follow the show on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and you can find our video versions at youtube.com/StarQuestMedia. To find previous episodes of Secret to Stargate and to send us feedback, please visit sqpn.com/Stargate. And you can email us at stargate@sqpn.com or follow StarQuest on social media at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia or on Twitter at sqpn. And we'll be back next time and we'll be discussing the next episode of SG-1, this time, Lockdown. Until then, Father Corey, thank you for joining us and sharing the secret to Stargate.
Thank you, Jack.
And Lisa Jones, thank you as well.
Thanks, Jack.
And Victor Lambs, thank you too.
Thanks, Jack, and we're in another bloody galaxy. How much more out can you get?
Aye. And once again, I'm Jack Brozini. Thank you for listening to The Secret to Stargate on StarQuest.
Anyway, I'm sorry, but that just happens to be how I feel about it. What do you think?
Here's another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy. PlayStation Portable. Find it wherever fine podcasts are found or at starquest.fm/PSP.